Today we continue with the third program in our series on the Radio Cafe, Thinking Like a Watershed, a series of panel discussions that focus on responses to the water crisis in the West. Each of these panels is intended to provide various cultural perspectives concerning global warming and climate change. They are produced and moderated by author and oral historian Jack Leffler. Today's panel features rancher Sid Goodlow from El Capitan, New Mexico, author and farmer Stanley Crawford from Dixon, and outfitter and director of the Rio Grande Restoration, Steve Harris.
Hello, and thank you so much for coming this evening. It's really great to see you here. I have to say that two nights ago, which was the evening of Earth Day 44, I did a lecture up in Los Alamos, and there were about 60 people in the audience. And I was the youngest person in the room. So that gives you something to think about. As Craig said, what we're trying to do with these five panels that we're producing and putting on here is create a series of different perspectives for people to be able to understand various ways of looking at not just the water crisis in the West, but also what is it about our system of cultural attitudes that is erroneous? In other words, how are we going to shift our perspectives around to be able to fit within the needs of our planet Earth at this point? Because we haven't done such a great job, and the last century really has brought us to the point of major jeopardy. Let's put it that way. That's a positive way of looking at it. But at any rate, tonight we're really lucky to have wonderful thinkers who are going to, each person will make a presentation, a brief presentation, 8 to 10 minutes, about their own particular perspectives. And then after that, we'll have a panel discussion where we'll talk about certain areas that each one of us has a long and enduring interest in. Our panelists this evening include farmer, author, Stanley Crawford, who has done a whole array of books. We're very lucky to have Stan. He has a beautiful farm up in Dixon, New Mexico, where I was last week, and I was just undone. He has this beautiful field of growing garlic, and that's a very spicy way to spend your day. It's a wonderful thing. Our second panelist is an amazing person. I've heard him characterized as not just a rancher, but a visionary. His name is Sid Goodlow. And Sid has a ranch down sort of near Carrizozo and El Capitan, down in that neck of the woods. And it's a beautifully restored ranch that back in 1956 was pretty cow-burnt, as a friend of mine would characterize it. And Sid has restored it to a beautiful habitat. And our third panelist is another person for whom I have enormous respect. He's the director of Rio Grande Restoration, and he's also the proprietor of Far Flung Adventures. And his name is Steve Harris. Steve is a river rat. I have been in my life. I'm sort of too old to run rivers anymore. The hard part about running a river these days for me is all the other people who are out there running on rivers. But at any rate, we're really lucky to have these panelists. There will be a fourth person on the stage with us this evening, and that is Cheryl Goodlow, Sid's wife. And so without further ado, I'd like to introduce Stan, Sid, Steve, and Cheryl. Come on out. We will begin with Stan Crawford, who will give his presentation and inspire all of us, I'm sure. Go right ahead, Stan.
Thank you, Jack. After the first panel, I began thinking about what I was going to say as I was driving back to Dixon. When Jack came up to interview me last week or so, he said he was an optimist, which reminded me of a remark of an old friend in Brooklyn who said that an optimist is someone who knows how bad things are. A pessimist is someone who's just learning. I'm an optimist. I'm going to talk about water. I'm going to allude to water, but I'm taking a somewhat left turn on this whole matter. The current drought is a symptom. There's not a lot we can do about it. There's some things we can do about it. It's a symptom, of course, of global warming, and that, in turn, is caused by a fossil fuel consumption the world over. And that we can do something about, all of us. Conservation will take us so far, but I'm hoping my other panelists here will give me some more hope here. The vision that I have is New Mexico, eventually northern New Mexico, becoming like Chaco Canyon with a few campgrounds with taps and a visitor center, but no more water than that. But again, I hope I'm wrong there. On our small farm, we grow about an acre and a half of alliums and greens and other crops. We converted to drip irrigation a few years back. And so we're able to irrigate this entire place through an inch and a half pipe. So we're using much less water than with flood irrigation. And there are many other advantages to drip, which I was slow to learn but came to appreciate. There are also a couple of disadvantages, mainly with the consumption of plastic. As for the ultimate cause, fossil fuel consumption, we've tried to deal with that in various ways on the farm through a number of solar features. We had photovoltaic panels installed on the guest house, 3.65 kilowatts. And we last summer, we rebuilt and expanded our attached solar greenhouse and installed a heat pump water heater, which pulls heat out of the air in the greenhouse and turns it into hot water. Our propane consumption has dropped radically. We also have three trome walls, which are basically very thin greenhouses on the guest house, and there are two on the house. Basically, the heat is stored in the adobe walls and migrates over the course of the night. Our ultimate goal is to have enough PV. We need photovoltaics to add. We need to add a couple of more panels so we can have a plug-in hybrid. Now, this won't solve or cure the drought. But by reducing fossil fuel consumption, we can begin to stabilize the climate. There are several hundred million people out there in the developed world who could afford to do this. We did this. We're not wealthy. We had to borrow money to do almost everything. And because we pay only self-employment tax, we haven't been able to benefit from tax credits. But I think it's so important to do this stuff that we've done it however we can. It's been argued that the problem with solar photovoltaics is that you have to pay your electric bill 20 years in advance. But that argument doesn't take into account the external pollution that you would be generating in those 20 years through fossil fuel consumption. And we're going to pay the price for that, those external costs. They're not going to be external for too much longer. They're going to become internal in terms of climate disruption, insurance costs, and so forth. To me, it's a compelling argument to do whatever you can. In a recent column in the Times, economist Paul Krugman noted that since 2008, solar panel prices have dropped more than 75%, and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has noted the substantial performance improvements in renewable energy technologies to the point that decarbonizing electricity generation is a realistic goal. I quote, "So is the climate threat solved?" Well, it should be. The science is solid. The technology is there. The economics look far more favorable than anyone expected. All that stands in the way of saving the planet is a combination of ignorance, prejudice, and vested interests. What could go wrong? Oh, wait, he says. Solar is something that we can all do. You don't own your own house? Get your landlord, your school, your university, your employer, your government agencies, your local businesses. Some of you know that George Gundry, who owns Tomasita's up in Santa Fe, installed a solar parking shed, which covers a lot of his electrical needs for the restaurant. Perhaps, I don't know whether this is important or not, but it feels important to me. The nice thing about doing something is that it feels a lot better than doing nothing. And enough people do it, we might actually keep the planet habitable. Perhaps without even having to turn to that last desperate, complex, and controversial resort, geoengineering. Okay. All right.
Thank you very much, Stan. Boy. I have to say, Stan is actually living a reality that I think it would behoove many of us to live, because he's doing it, not just talking about it. Our next speaker is a friend from southeastern New Mexico, has the most beautiful ranch you could possibly imagine, and of course I'm referring to Sid Goodloe. Thanks, Sid.
Thank you, Jack. I'm going to talk about water production, not water adjudication or conservation or any other of the terms we use with our shortage of water. I'm going to talk to you about production, and water production comes from a properly functioning watershed. And New Mexico does not have properly functioning watersheds. Neither does the Southwest, as far as that's concerned. So I'm going to show you why we got into the non-production situation. The people that settled New Mexico came from a non-brittle environment where we had a lot of rain and no wind and warm weather and high humidity, to a brittle environment where we have low humidity, high winds, high temperatures, and low rainfall. And this is a paper done at the University of Arizona by Nathan Sayer. In 1870, there were 40,000 head of cattle in southern Arizona. In 1891, there were 1,500,000. So you can see what a massive movement of livestock we experienced in those years. In 92 and 93, it didn't rain at all. 75% of those cattle died, but they had already done the damage. I have a couple of slides here to give you an example of what happened after a period of massive livestock numbers and fire suppression. These pictures are taken 100 years apart. Our ranch is to the right of the big mountain there, Carrizo Mountain. You can see what the invasion of water-hungry plants was doing at that time. The invasion of these juniper, pinon, and ponderosa trees is just uncountable. From 20 to 25 trees to the acre, we're up to 2,000. So you can imagine how much water they use. Actually, in an area in the juniper ecosystem where you have 106 inch juniper trees per acre, they use 9 inches of precipitation a year, which is half of what we get. So you can imagine what happens to the aquifers in those areas. This is several photographs taken of young trees that have invaded grassland where we once had infiltration of water into the aquifer, and now it's beginning to be taken up by these young trees, and of course they are growing at a rapid rate. The increase in carbon dioxide in the air has increased tree growth, according to the USDA Agriculture Research Service, by three times, and they've got proof of that. I've got the bulletins. And you can't see it, but at the bottom it says in Mauna Loa in Hawaii, They've measured a 2% increase in the CO2 content of the air every year since 1958. So I can see, I've been there long enough, I've been on that ranch 58 years, and I can tell you that I can see the difference in the growth rate of these trees. The roots come out about 40 feet from the trunk of each tree, sapping the soil of nutrients and moisture, and consequently no herbaceous growth occurs. If you go out 40 feet from the trunk, dig a little ditch, take a hand sprayer and spray the dirt away from the soil, you get this kind of root growth, just like a hairnet, just solid under the surface of the ground, and it causes sheet erosion. This sheet erosion ends up with all the surviving grass plants up on a pedestal where they're not productive and they soon die. So sheet erosion causes a rapid movement of water across the land, and that causes our gullies all over the country. This is on the Forest Service up above our place where we have, over the years, there have been brush invasion, overgrazing, fire suppression, all put together have caused these gullies and this sheet erosion. What we're doing now, we're going to talk a little bit about what we're doing to solve the problem. One of them is thinning, of course, and we do this by cutting fuel wood, and we sell it in Rio Doce to the Texans over there that like to smell piñon. And I have my own opinion of the piñon smell. I think it kind of counteracts the smell of that other Colorado-type vegetation. But cutting firewood is getting a little bit hard for us. We do a lot of it, but otherwise we use heavy equipment and push these trees up and get them out of the way and stir up the soil. That soil's been capped for 50 years at least, and it needs to be broken up. A lot of people don't like that, but I think it's necessary. These are the kind of thickets that we clean up. It's just really a biological desert. There's not anything that really likes that. The wildlife, the lions can get the deer, and the cows can get the fawns, and the bobcats can get the turkeys in those thickets. So we're cleaning all that up. And when we're through, it looks really rough. But I can tell you from experience that a cat track is the best seed bed you can have. We go back and we throw out native grass seeds on these on these areas where the cat's been, and we, if it rains, of course, we get a wonderful stand. And that's what happens later. If you get a rain, this will be the next year. We have in the past, I can hardly remember that far back, but we have had rain, and we've had some good results. We pile that brush against the green brush and then wait a year and burn it, and we kill about three or four trees for every tree we push, so it makes it more economical to open the country up and make it a more desirable wildlife habitat and a much more productive watershed. In the Ponderosa ecosystem, we thin that also, and we have to pay for those things, of course, by selling fuel wood and vigas. We peel these vigas and sell them also to those Texas folks in Rio Doce. This was an absolute thicket you could hardly walk through. And we've left the better trees, and they'll make logs in 20 or 30 years. And we've got the ground covered with a mulch, and we went back in there also and seeded it. We've accomplished what we want. We've got a properly functioning watershed there instead of a tree thicket that's sucking all the water out of the ground. We use herbicide also to accomplish our production point. These Velpar pellets, you can purchase them anywhere in a hardware store. One pellet will kill a juniper tree. Grazing is another thing that we have to do to keep our management holistic. We use short-duration grazing. We started that in 1971. It's now called planned grazing, and it's worked very well. Riparian areas I'd like to mention briefly. Riparian areas cover less than 2% of the state of New Mexico, and they're very easy to focus on. If it comes a long period of dry weather like we've had, these riparian areas become very attractive to the livestock and wildlife, and if you don't fence it, they'll absolutely just live there. And I, of course, I don't blame them, but we have. We fenced our riparian areas. The only problem is we can't keep the elk out, so they do catch a lot of pressure from the elk. Talk about fire now. In the University of Arizona, they have a tree ring research center. They can absolutely predict the year that all these fires occurred. If you'll look, that center pith there was 1700. You see all the fires that occurred between 1700 and 1900. And, of course, because all the fuel was gone to carry fires after 1900, there were no more fires. That's pretty impressive. This is an area near Sholo, Arizona, where that Rodeo Chudesky fire occurred. That was a ponderosa thicket that was absolutely worthless. It cleaned it up. They flew on the seed from the air, and now they have a productive watershed. On Carrizo Valley Ranch, we try to burn and keep the population down by burning in the summertime. If we get rain and the grass is green, the fire can't get away. And this is what we're aiming for. This is a productive ponderosa woodland that is not a thicket that's unfavorable to wildlife and using up all the water. And lastly here, I'd like to mention that if we don't control off-road vehicle traffic on our public lands, they're going to do more damage to our watersheds than anything else has ever done. Everybody now has got a four-wheeler or a dirt bike or a four-wheel drive pickup, and they've got to be controlled. We have done a little bit in that regard in the Lincoln National Forest, so it's the only forest in the state that has off-road vehicle regulations. We have tours and workshops that come out, and we try to explain to them on the ground what we're doing to improve the production of a watershed. And I can tell you it really registers with a lot of people that have never had that experience. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sid. Actually, visiting Sid and Cheryl's ranch has been a real pleasure for me over the years, and a lot of good sense spoken here. Thank you. And finally, we have Steve Harris, who is a great river runner, but is also in charge of the Rio Grande Restoration Project. And Steve is going to talk to us about some of our river situations here in New Mexico.
Thank you, Jack. It's a great pleasure to be here with you guys tonight. I really have admired Jack's work with natural resources and with landscapes and voices, and think it's done a lot to help improve things, at least the way that we regard our natural heritage here in the West. And so I'm proud to be contributing a little something this evening. Jack mentioned I own a rafting company and have a small nonprofit. The home landscape I've selected now is northern New Mexico. And by the way, Sid, we've got a solution for gullying we use up there. We just throw the old car bodies off into the gully. And you might try that down in Carrizozo.
Old cars.
So this is, everybody's got some kind of impression or experience of what whitewater rafting is all about, but we don't really have a product to sell out there unless we've got, one, water, and two, some semblance of a natural ecosystem, something that feels wild and looks wild and is wild. Okay. I do a lot of presentations in Lynn Montgomery, Mike on or out there. You guys know it wouldn't be an Uncle Steve production if I didn't have a hydrograph. Okay, what's showing here is the red line is our water demands in the Colorado River Basin, human water demands. And the blue line is the historical supply, and what's significant about this is that the lines are crossing. And in fact, the way that policies work in the southwestern United States is that we can literally dry rivers up. We can give away more water rights than there is actually any expectation that we would have water. The thesis I'm trying to present to you tonight is that we have had a way of dealing with water ever since the Anglo-American culture came and took over the West in the 1840s. So from 1849 to present, it's our relationship with natural water courses has been to control them. So most of my career has been spent on the Rio Grande, working on the Rio Grande. I've tried to influence policy in New Mexico to be more river friendly, to have ways that we can deal with the doctrine of maximum utilization that we've inherited from all of this development in the West. And along comes a case study, and this is the Gila River. How many folks have been into the Gila country? This is in southwestern New Mexico. This is a backwater area. Its population growth is flat. Its dominant economy is mining. Probably second dominant economy is tourism and outdoor recreation, and third is agriculture, all of which have their particular water needs. So SIDS kind of primed us for thinking a little bit about watersheds and riparian areas, and the Gila River watershed is actually principally America's first and the lower 48's largest designated wilderness area. It's Gila National Forest. There's very close to 1 million acres that are placed into protection around 1900. So we've got an opportunity here in New Mexico. The Interstate Stream Commission is driving the truck on the spending of about $93 million in federal subsidies. We've got a choice in southwestern New Mexico right now. We can build a project. We have an opportunity to take more water out of the Gila River, which is fully appropriated and never makes it to the Colorado. We're going to use the Gila River Indian Reservation's water, and they're going to take water out of the Central Arizona Project. Hence, we've got federal money to build the New Mexico unit of the Central Arizona Project to take 14,000 acre-feet of water, about what Santa Fe drinks in a year, out of the Gila. At the same time, the legislation was written so that if we don't want to do a diversion project, that we can spend that money on any other water utilization project in southwestern New Mexico. By the end of the year, the Interstate Stream Commission will send a letter to the Secretary of Interior saying we want to build the New Mexico unit of the Central Arizona Project, or not send a letter. Sending the letter puts the wheels in progress to begin a project that looks at least conceptually like this. This is Mesilla Dam down in the lower Rio Grande. But it's going to be 7 miles up into the de facto wilderness, an area that the Forest Service calls the Gila River Primitive Area, put a barricade from wall to wall, and then either put the water in canals on both sides of the river using gravity to get it into off-channel storage in some arroyos. About 3 or 4 arroyos will become reservoirs. Thence to pipe this over the Continental Divide into the Mimbres Basin. Some of it presumably will be sold to Silver City. Other of it will be presumably sold to Deming. The reason I'm kind of acting on the assumption, maybe you've noticed this, I'm assuming that we're going to go ahead and build this dam, because I don't think we've quite gotten over that era of development. That's our first recourse. Anytime we find ourselves water short, we're going to go and look for another source of water. And so people are seriously talking about solving Colorado River Basin problems by massive engineering projects, bringing water from Lake Superior, towing icebergs in, multi-billion, probably trillion-dollar desal plant on the Gulf of California and pipelines to Phoenix and L.A. and so forth. That's just, we're still thinking that way. However, you can see that we've got this opportunity. We've got a chunk of money that's not, it's already come out of our pocketbooks. All of the federal taxpayers have contributed this, and they're is a suite of alternatives that could actually meet the foreseeable water needs in southwestern New Mexico. The acronym AWSA means Arizona Water Settlements Act, and Arizona Water Settlements basically is how we got this 18,000 acre-feet of water, or 14,000 now, and it's basically Clinton P. Anderson, New Mexico's senior senator so many years ago, in order to get his vote and his concurrence in the Senate of the United States to build the Central Arizona Project, the massive pipeline from the Colorado River, we were promised this water. So this is our legacy from the 1960s. And right now, the official estimated costs of this project are about $500 million. As I mentioned, the subsidy is worth about $100 million, leaving somebody to pick up the bill here. Typically in these reclamation projects, it's going to be the end user that that puts out a bond or takes a federal loan and pays it back painstakingly year by year. But in an area with whose largest county's population is 26,000 people, Catron County is less than 10,000 people, and the county containing Deming and the county containing Lordsburg have promised to have difficulty in servicing a bond to pay this other unsubsidized amount. The Interstate Stream Commission has agreed to analyze 13 non-diversion alternatives. Four of these are watershed projects, and I think Sid made the case pretty well that certainly a healthy watershed has some benefits. The fires that have raged through the Gila Wilderness three of the past 5 years have created havoc, debris flows, and so forth in the communities. 13 of 28 stream segments that used to contain Gila trout, because of the fire, no longer support Gila trout. Water quality standards are not being achieved, and it shows up down in the river pretty quick. Grant County also has several communities that are not going to have water much longer. They've been gifted water by Freeport-McMoRan, the big copper mining company. The mines are promising to close, and Hurley and to some degree Baird are going to have problems with water supply. So the Grant County, where Silver City is the seat, has a $15 million infrastructure project that they would like to build. And with that, they've got reuse, recycling, and the sort of water conservation that's those of us that live in Albuquerque have become accustomed to: zero escape, flow fixtures, educational messages, groundwater recharge, and so forth. And watershed restoration. So I know I've gone over time. I'm going to quit. Back to you, Jack.
Thanks, Steve. Well, these are amazing things to have to think about. One of the thoughts that I've had with regard to what's happening down in the Gila and all of that money that's going to be spent, if it gets spent doing this to the Gila, which is contributing ever more to the Central Arizona Project, which Bill DeBuise, who was here for our very first panel, and with whom I concur, is that the Central Arizona Project is conceivably the worst environmental debacle ever visited upon the American Southwest. It deals with massive interbasin transfers of water, and it creates a false sense of water security no matter where you go. Even here in Albuquerque and in Santa Fe, the San Juan Chama Diversion is bringing in water from the Navajo River and a couple of other areas up in the northeastern corner. And we've grown to rely on that kind of water. One of the thoughts, and I want to bring this up and see how everybody reacts to this, is the idea of using that money for watershed restoration projects rather than rearranging the Gila River. Is this something that piques anybody's interest and want to respond to?
I think it's something they better do. They better start thinking about what they're going to have in the Gila River in 20 or 30 years if they don't do something about the restoration of the watershed.
And yeah, one of the ways this shows up is in these farming valleys, particularly the Cliff Gila Valley, a lovely little farming valley. It's using push-up dams that after every flood they have to push more gravel up to get some head to get the water out into the leaky ditches to do the flood irrigation. And they really, you know, since about 1900, the record shows steady declines in late season stream flow. So many years they can't continue to irrigate their crops in July and August, and of course, no crop production, no wealth created in the little valley there. So I certainly believe that they should be supporting the idea of watershed restoration, of good soft improvements to their irrigation system and harden those diversions so they don't wash out all the time. But they'd rather go the route of getting the free water, if indeed it is free water.
Well, one of the things that part of what these panels that we're putting together here are trying to focus on is the notion of thinking like a watershed, which isn't just thinking about the water within the watershed. It's trying to look at what a watershed really is. In other words, you can look at the horizons up and down along the Rio Grande, and everything that's coming down into the Rio Grande, that constitutes the watershed. The watershed is a geophysical cradle for an entire biotic community, and it's that biotic community of which we share membership that is in a state of jeopardy due to the lengthening drought. One of the things that I think is important to try to think about, and people like our folks here on the panel have to think about this a lot, and that's uncertainty. How does that get you?
Well, I think I told you this account when you were up at the farm, Jack, back when we had the worst drought that anybody could remember in 2004. So we have 9 acequias in the Embuna Valley, or 10. The commissioners gathered every Sunday evening to figure out how to allocate the declining flow of water, and the first meetings lasted hours. As time went on, it got down at the end of the season. The meetings took 10 minutes. They finally figured it out. The principle was that everybody would, under the Spanish tradition, everybody would share. So, as I said before, everyone got an hour of a small stream of water for their gardens or fields every 12 days, which, of course, was not enough to keep things alive. But a commissioner friend, I was no longer on the commission of my acequia, said that it was the most gratifying community experience he'd ever participated in. The problem is that went on for 2 years, for 2 summers, and then things started getting better. If something like, and these are volunteer commissioners, 27 or more, Myrtle, where they're paid. If this goes on for more than 2 or 3 years, are these volunteers, and I'm now a commissioner again, are they going to keep up with this? So we're vulnerable over a very short period of time, maybe 3-4 years. It could be all over, or it could collapse, not that it couldn't be rebuilt if the water returns. That to me is the big unknown, the big unexpected, the big question. How long can we keep doing this when in fact we don't get what we are doing it for, which is enough water to grow our crops?
Well, this brings up a question, which I know all of us here have thought about for a long time, and that is, can we afford to keep increasing population-wise and development-wise in a habitat that has diminishing water resources. And I think that this is one of the big, you know, this is a level of conflicting absolutes that is absolutely imperative to look at right now. Can anybody talk about that a little bit? Future development.
Well, I think we're going to have the influx of population and the development, whether we like it or not. We've just got to figure out a way to supply the water. And the way to supply the water is to return the watersheds to their production ability. And that's done like I just showed you. It's by getting rid of these water-hungry plants that don't belong there. In the eastern part of the state, it's mesquite. In the western part of the state, it's sagebrush. In the other ecosystems, it's pinon, juniper, ponderosa, whatever. But they don't belong here. This state was basically a savanna where it wasn't just open rangeland. And we've got to return it to a savanna ecosystem. And it will then produce.
One of the things that Craig Newbill, director of the New Mexico Humanities Council, pointed out to me a couple of months ago, was that over the last 2 years, the human population of New Mexico has actually diminished by up to 20,000 people a year.
Really?
And both Craig and I know people who are moderately well-to-do, who've been here for a while, but are planning on leaving. And the more people who leave, the better off we are. A lot of
Jack, if I may, there's the demand side of things too, and I recently toured some Mike Reynolds Earthship homes up in Taos that use about 40 gallons to perform all of their day's activities for a family of four, and that's right in line with what the UN has established as kind of the human need for water, 15 gallons a person or so a day. What are we using in Albuquerque right now? We 135, 136. So, and we're breaking our arms, patting ourselves on the back for that. And it is a pretty good achievement. But, you know, between the 135 we're using now and the 15 we need, there's a lot of opportunities there to increase our resiliency. One thing that drives me nuts is we just had a water town hall last week, and a lot of the talk at the water town hall was about deep saline aquifers, such as the one that lies west of Rio Rancho. These are fossil aquifers that it's going to take a lot of energy to pump. We're going to have brine left over at the end of things, and we're actually, the community is proposing to grow on that water supply, that finite diminishing water supply. And it seems to be okay according to our policies. If that source will last 40 years, who cares about the rest?
You know, one of the things that this brings up to me, and it's something that when we were talking the other day, Stan, fascinated me, and that's how you are very much involved in co-ops and farmers markets and that sort of a situation. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the kind of a role they could play in the community as becoming even some sort of a sustainable political base from within the watershed relative to constantly being governed by government agencies that are not necessarily in our favor.
Well, I think it was mentioned at that first panel with Bill and John and Patty. That Bill McKibben was quoted, that the one thing we can do in the face of what we fear is coming is work on our own communities to make them more resilient and self-sufficient in certain respects. And this goes back to the previous discussion, I was thinking that, you know, we're in really a rather bizarre situation for an arid state, an arid region, with the way water is administered and regulated, state engineer, interstate stream, environmental, you know, on and on, the various agencies that oversee water use. And I believe the Upper Rio Grande has not yet been adjudicated. We collectively really don't know very much about the water that we do have. And so it has been over-appropriated, that we do know. But it's to me very strange, and I'm not saying that it's something I particularly desire, but I think our ignorance is startling, and I think it the state agencies are also suffering from it. I think the state engineer's office is probably grossly underfunded. I was told in 1974 that by, I think it was Elud Martinez, who was not yet state engineer, that he thought the Embuna Valley would be, this is 1974, would be adjudicated in about 15 years. Well, gosh, no sign of anything. Not that that's something I particularly want to happen. But there's a pretty big disconnect between the reality on the ground, which I think we all are experiencing in various ways, and what the official, the governmental entities know, I would say.
One of the things that I sort of philosophically ponder frequently is how much our thinking is clouded by our overemphasis on economics and underemphasis on ecology, actually. I think that's one of the big flaws in our system of cultural coordinates right now. And one of the things that I'm hoping is that the more of us who can really get involved in this kind of thinking, the more likely we can evolve a system of cultural coordinates that's more commensurate with ourselves relative to our habitat, our home habitat. Another thing that I want to mention is that those of us in this room who are over 75 have witnessed a tripling of the human population in our lifetimes. Well, I'm getting signals from afar. Brother Newbill tells me that we're about done for the evening, but first of all, I want to thank all of you folks for coming to water panel number 3 this evening, and then I want to thank Stan Crawford, Sid Goodlow, and Steve Harris, and thank you so much. Thank you.
And that was Jack Loeffler, Sid Goodlow, Stanley Crawford, and Steve Harris in the third in a series of 5 panel discussions on water, culture, and climate change in the West, Thinking Like a Watershed, recorded at the Chemo Theater in Albuquerque. We are airing the series each Monday for another 2 weeks. Next week, the fourth panel discussion will address the evolution of water laws in the Southwest and the present attempt to privatize water for commercial profit in the plains of San Augustine, and when human legislation violates natural law. The panelists will include author and Professor M. Hall from the University of New Mexico, Bruce Frederick from the New Mexico Environmental Law Center here in Santa Fe, and Peter Pino from the Zia Pueblo. Tune in next week at this time. The panels are funded and sponsored by the New Mexico Humanities Council and the Lore of the Land. They are produced and moderated by oral historian, author, and producer Jack Loeffler.